Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast. My guest today is Justin McKinney, guitarist for the band The Zenith Passage, who has a new album out called Ad Elysium. And honestly, I think this is one of the best tech death albums I've heard in maybe like a decade or two. Like, I think that you've got Necrophagist, Arcspire, and these guys as maybe my three favorite tech death bands. Surreptions in there as well. And I think that Justin's guitar playing, it's super, super signature and characteristic. I mean, he sounds like himself and nobody else. I think that you could describe his sound as ultra, ultra precise, mechanical, but not in a soulless kind of way. It's hard to explain, but he sounds like a machine, and he comes up with the most interesting harmonic content. Like, it's kind of a man after my own heart with his harmonic tendencies, but the way he sounds when he plays it, let's just say you can't fake that because it's so low gain and it's so tight. You know that only someone who would sit there 12 hours a day and really would work out every single last detail would be capable of pulling that off. And that's what I wanted to talk to him about. So without further ado, I bring you Justin McKinney. Justin McKinney, welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast.
What's up, dude?
Well, I mean, we were just talking about some interesting stuff. So before we started recording, we were talking about collective experiences we've had with metal mixers. And like, first of all, like, you know, I feel this way, but I think that your new record is the best Dave Otero mix I've ever heard. And it's like a killer, killer record. But so it's interesting what you were saying before about how there were certain parts that the rhythm guitars were mixed loud and that you had to do a lot of work and a lot of thinking about where they should be level-wise compared to everything else, because you had other elements in there. And I want to talk about that because I just went through the same thing with Jens Bogren on the new Doth, where, you know, we have 8 million layers. So there's always his version of the mix would be the first thing that I'd hear. And sometimes it would be like 99% there, other times 90% there, always really close. But it really, the issues were not like quality of mix or anything like that. It was always like interpretation. Like when you give somebody who's not in your head, like 200 layers.
Yeah.
There's lots of room for interpretation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot for someone who's like not in your mind to figure out what exactly you're going for. So yeah, communication, I feel like is key, and having like examples is important, I think, too. And yeah, like what we were talking about is one of the songs on our, or a couple of the songs on our record, there was some instances where the rhythmic guitar was louder than the orchestration happening and the synth. And the way I intended is the rhythmic guitars, you know, they're supposed to be more of a texture, like a percussive texture, as opposed to like being at the forefront of the mix, which is great. But in my mind, like I thought the orchestration needed to be up front and needed to be a little more, you know, the focus than the guitars. So, I brought that up to Dave, and Dave like would give me the reasoning and why he'd do that. And then I'd give him the reasoning and my interpretation of the part that I wrote. And then we would come to a happy medium with that. And, that was like what was pretty cool, like working with Dave, because like you were saying, like no one really knows how to balance, like what if you deliver like a trillion like orchestral tracks, they're like, okay, well, we're what's sitting where, like, so they just, I feel like a lot of the time they go off what their ear is. Mm-hmm. And then you come together and try to figure out like what the real like effect is for this moment. And then you come to like a really awesome mixing conclusion.
Yeah. So out of curiosity, what was the reason in that part, or what were reasons that he gave you for, you know, having rhythm guitars louder than layers.
Well, Dave's like, he's very hi-fi and he's a real, not stickler, but he's really cognizant of the balance of everything. And obviously like orchestration and synth suck up almost everything in the mix. And then you're also battling, you know, highly distorted guitars, or not for us, not highly distorted, but you get a distorted guitars.
Still pretty distorted.
Yeah. So like these are two things that are clashing. So, his reasoning was, well, if I do this, then like all you're going to hear is just the synth. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm cool with that because I was like, I want that thing to be as loud as everything. But Dave had to like kind of reality check me and be like, if you do this, like it's going to compromise like the entire part of the song. And then like the next part's going to be affected because of that.
Yes, exactly. Which is really good to understand. I know lots of people who have gone to mixers and gotten back like mixes where the rhythm guitar is the loudest thing. And they'll get mad. Like this dude is ignoring all the work we put into these other parts and just basically throwing it out the window because they have a very narrow understanding of what music should sound like. But that's not it. That's not it at all. It's just there's a trade-off to everything. And if you're trying to put out a metal record that sounds like metal, like, and has like, I guess, checks the boxes for what metal sounds like. And I realize metal is like the most varied genre on earth, but still there's something about metal records where the sound of an album typically stays consistent through the whole album. It's not like some other genres where every song gets started from scratch. Sometimes like metal records have this consistency thing, and doing that right there, what we're talking about of like turning the rhythm guitars down or having them not be dominant, is like a 180 on the consistency. It's basically you're throwing the consistency out the window, which is not like a value judgment, but you should know that that's what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like to expand on what you're saying, like, this is a problem that I've had. Like I would take it personal, like, oh, why are you like burying all that shit I just did? Like, that's like,
yeah, me too. Like,
a so long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like coming to Dave and him, like, it's not like I took what Dave did personal, but it's just something I've learned over the years. But like Dave having to explain the reasoning and why, and then me explaining the reasoning and why I did that, like it helped like drive the mix in a, you know, better direction, like a more productive direction. Cause it's like, yeah, it's open for interpretation. Like when you're handing in like all these tracks, and it's like, there's like a fuck ton of layers of just orchestration and synth. And it's like, some of them don't even really make sense. Like, it's like you're doubling three pads. Like, why are you doing that? So it's like,
yeah, exactly.
You have to like tell them your reasoning, and then you can like come to a conclusion. Like for me, I was using my demos as a way to like explain, oh, like this is what I was, you know, intending. And then Dave's like, dude, there's like no balance to this demo. He's like, this is like fucked up. Like, I'm okay, but I've heard it for so long, for the past like 3 years, I can't unhear it now. And like,
yes,
to say like, well, this is why you're coming to me, you know, like I'm doing this in my way of doing things. And you've heard it for so long that it's hard to like shake that off, you know, like your demo that you've been working on for 4 or 5 years or however long, like it kind of gets stuck in your mind of how it should sound. So like when you hear something that's different, it like throws you off and you get like freaked out. I don't know, it's weird.
Absolutely. Like Jens actually pointed this out to me, where, and I knew it, but like never like thought about it exactly in these words. But when I put some words to this idea, it all made sense. He said that especially people who are recording their own pre-pro or recording their own tracks. Typically, they get used to listening to whatever it is that they worked on, like 10 dB too loud. And that's how it is. So like if you have a keyboard player who recorded their own keyboards, well, they're sitting there monitoring probably 10 dB too loud, somewhere in that range. And that's what they get used to. You have a lead guitar player recording their own solos. Well, solos are going to be loud as fuck. And they're used to them loud as fuck because, well, I mean, they got to hear what they're doing in order to record it. Vocalists. So especially nowadays where people do record a lot of their own stuff and a lot of it is kind of done in like separate, I guess a lot of it is done separately. You get even more of every musician wanting their own parts louder. And they don't think that they're coming at it from a perspective of ego. It's actually more of a perspective of they're used to hearing it this way. Their listening situation has been so imbalanced and they got so used to it that, then they hear it at a proper level and it sounds too quiet. And it's really hard to adjust to that. But then at the same time, knowing that when you get a mix and the levels are wrong, you got to ask yourself, am I married to the demo and the wacky levels on my demo, or are the levels actually wrong in this? And that drives me crazy.
Yeah. It's always hard to like let go, you know? It's like something you've been working on so long and then like it goes to the studio and you're like, wait, what happened? Oh, it's different now. And then like when you start listening to those a lot more and then you like have mixed notes and then you keep hearing different mixed notes. And then I feel like you start like having like, it's like, it becomes like a balance between what you intended and what the mixing engineer is trying to do. So.
Yeah. Does it make you nuts?
Sometimes I like freak out. I'm like, fuck dude, like that's not what I wanted. And I'm like freaking out. Like the first like couple passes I was freaking out. I'm like, dude, like this is not like how this part is supposed to sound. Like it's supposed to have this big synth, you know, part happening. And it like took a while for me to like digest the fact that it's just going to sound different. And the drums too. Like, you know, I've been listening to the same like drum patch that I made like for so long, with TuneTrack. So, it was like hard to hear the drums differently too. You know, like if you're so used to the nuance in the snare, you know, like, and it's a totally different snare now. You're like, what the fuck, dude? Like it changes everything and you start freaking out. But yeah, it's like digesting and accepting that, hey, like this is for the better, you know, like stop, you know, living in the demo past, you know.
The demo past.
Yeah.
It's a very real thing. Do you ever go back and listen to your demos and be like, holy shit, I had that bass synth like 15 dB too loud. Like I would never be cool with, like if I was mixing something or a friend of mine's band had the synth at this level, I'd be like,
Yeah.
What do you got to fix that?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of do sometimes like I'll open up the project and like start messing with it with something like for live stuff. And I'm like, damn, like, there were some parts I'm like, oh, that kind of sounds sick. Mm-hmm. And there's some parts like, oh man, that's like, the hell was I thinking?
Yeah. I mean, granted, there's going to be some parts that do sound sick.
Yeah. Like some of the leads like sounded a little creamier and they had to be, you know, for Dave's defense, they have to sit in the mix at a certain way because it's battling everything else happening. So they might, in some instances, have like a little more fuzziness than like creaminess. Whereas like everything in my demo is just like all mid, you know, so it's,
yeah,
everything's just battling for placement. So, but yeah, like shit like that. But at the big picture, I wasn't really thinking in my demos, you know, I'm just thinking of like what you were saying earlier about the part for part and having everything 10 dB louder than one other thing.
Yeah. So when Dave would like give you his reasoning, how many versions usually would it take before you'd be somewhere you liked. I mean, you mentioned that he would sometimes just get there before you even responded.
Yeah, like it would be a thing where like he'd give us like the mix B or whatever, and then we'd be like, we'd start giving mix notes, and then a lot of the time, half the shit that I was gonna address or that I did address, he had already done it. Cause he probably took a break, came back and like realized like, oh, like let's try that. And then I'm like, oh, that's exactly what I was gonna say too. But a thing that we ran into, I noticed a lot, was like the level of the vocals. Like we thought the vocal levels were really quiet. And it was like a thing that everyone like collectively had to say. And like Dave's like, dude, this is louder than almost every record that I've done in terms of how like loud the vocals are. So we started like listening to it on like his car, and then in the studio, obviously nothing's going to sound as good as it does in his studio, but like having separate, like, cause we were using like our Macs, you know, to hear it, like, which is a horrible reference. And then like, you know, like headphones, which I think is kind of a bad reference. And then like, we were using Bluetooth speakers, which, you know, you can probably get some quality degradation there. So we finally got it into like his car, and his car's got like a really nice sound system. So we're like, oh yeah, that's like really loud. Why is it so loud? Like, why can't we hear that? So that was like a thing that we like tried to keep in mind after the fact of realizing that it was just like the way we were, you know, hearing playback. Cause it's like, we would like to be in his studio 24/7, but you know, he's got a life. So,
fucker.
Yeah.
Okay. So that right there, that vocal issue, man, that's, I feel that cause I've been there too. So how did, it's really disconcerting when you think that something is buried and every way that you've been listening to it, it sounds a certain way. Then you hear it like on a nice system and it's like perfect. And then I don't know, well, which way is right? Because don't most people listen in like shitty environments? Like,
exactly.
What should we be optimizing for?
Yeah, that was like a point that we brought up too. But yeah, like you would, okay, this is like my theory. Like most people listen to music on their way to work and from work, or mm-hmm. in their car, because of, you know, the access of Spotify. And, you know, if you still use CDs, like most of the time people are working all day, and if they do have music on, they're passively listening to it. So I don't really consider that listening to music, but like in your car, you're driving, you're more likely to be actively listening to the music because like you're fucking driving and you're in traffic. So I think that's like a factor in like the mixing. I'm like, okay, well, if most people are going to listen in their car, then we should always do a car test, you know, like, and make sure mm-hmm. that the car test is like, you know, good. And we did that with Dave. Like we got in his car and everything sounded sick. So it like translated pretty well from his like home studio to like his car. And then the same thing with my thing, like I would listen under my monitors and then I'd go in my car and I'm like, oh yeah, I hear like it actually translates well.
I'd say then car and AirPods, just because I feel it was same as podcasts, almost like the places that people consume podcasts the most are in the car on a way to work or at the gym with AirPods on.
Yep.
Also the same with music.
Yeah, absolutely. And like my thing with like the length of a record, like I know a lot of people want the, you know, the more the merrier, but I don't really believe that for, you know, in a death metal context, because it's like, for me, like I'm going to get fatigued after like the first like 40 minutes of death metal. I'm like over mm-hmm. it. Like I need to listen to something else. And that's like my reasoning. And I think a good death metal record should be 40 to 45 minutes and that's it. No one wants to listen to a death metal record for an hour. Like, I mean, maybe they do, but like, it's asking a lot, but I feel like the average drive to work is about 40 minutes. So you can like completely fulfill that record in that time. And then you get to work and then your day's going to be better. You're not going to always be wondering what happened next, you know?
you're doing a positive thing for people's days with that through death metal. My favorite death metal records, black metal too. Let's just say my favorite extreme metal records tend to be on the shorter side.
Yeah. It's great. And I think it has higher replay value.
Yeah.
You know, if you get the record so much, you're going to want to like, fuck, that was so good. I got to listen to it again. I want more.
28 like, minutes.
Yeah. 28 minutes is great. Like, I guess the Sumerian record special, which is like what a 20 to 30 minute record is what a lot of Sumerian records are. Like Planetary Duality, was it like 30 minutes? Like that Born of Osiris New Reign is like 20 minutes. It's like eight songs or how many songs? It's like a really short amount of songs, but dude,
20 minutes?
It's like a short record.
Fuck yeah.
But I remember as a kid listening to that, I could not stop listening to it. I had that CD in my car for like a year. It was crazy.
So Raining Blood. I mean, Rain in Blood is 28 minutes, I believe. The Necrophagist Epitaph, I believe, is like also 28 or 29.
Yeah, it's 29 or is it 30 minutes? And it has what, eight tracks?
Something like that. It's short.
But it's that's another record that you just can replay. Like the replay value is so high on it. Yeah, yes. 30 minutes, eight songs. It's like a journey, you know, like you can get through it and you're like, fuck, dude, I want to like revisit that.
Yeah, it's something where I think labels, man, I love labels, and but also, I feel like, you know, we're both on Metal Blade and my experience so far in regards to this has been very positive. I have been in a label situation in the past where they just wanted more and more and more songs on the record. And so you end up putting songs that really honestly shouldn't be there. Like they're not making it better. They're actually making it worse. And they really, really wanted more songs and more time. And they had reasons for it that I didn't agree with then. And I don't agree with now. Like the audience is going to feel like they're not getting their money's worth. And I just don't think that's true, because I don't think the audience judges records based on their length, unless if it's too long and they get bored, then they're judging it on length. But I don't know anyone, and I've never heard someone saying that they felt ripped off by a great record that's on the shorter side.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's some people who, you know, like there's nothing wrong with wanting to like listen to like extreme metal at like for like very long periods. But I mean, maybe it's because I'm a little grown up now, but I can't listen to like one death metal record for more than like 40 minutes. Cause I just get bored.
Yeah.
But
I think that that's pretty common.
Yeah. So it's like, I understand like the label, like maybe wanting to get more, but I don't know how much we can talk about this publicly about like Metal Blade's situation and that, but we're like not going to ever do more than 10 songs. Like there's just, this is how it is. And I feel like,
great.
Yeah. Plus like, it's like the royalty thing. It's different when you go over 10 songs and all this stuff, but
that's not just with them. That's with,
yeah,
lots of label. Yeah. You shouldn't ever do more than 10 songs on a standard label deal.
Yeah, totally. And plus like, I mean, as a listener, I would much rather have a solid 8 to 10 songs that are, you know, very cohesive and they're thought out and it's not a fucking like filler track. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I'm thinking of like longer records. So Opeth have some longer records, but I'm okay with that because it's not all death metal. And that's key. Like it's like half death metal.
Yeah. It's like a journey. It's like being in a long car ride, you know, like and taking a scenic route with Opeth.
It's a good way to put it.
Yeah. That's why like it's hard to not want to finish an Opeth record.
Yeah. The boredom factor though is very real for me with death metal. But that's actually one of the reasons I really like your record is I don't get that. It doesn't do that to me. So I have this thing with death metal where Usually, no matter how sick it is, halfway through the second song, I'm out. And it's not that I don't like it. I'm just not, my brain's disengaged. It's, I think too much of the same, like too much. It's like too much and not enough variation.
Exactly. I went to go see Yngwie a couple weeks ago, and
nice.
It's like, the guy's an absolute virtuoso, like phenomenal. He's a showman. Like everything about it is awesome. But it's like, you can only listen to Harmonic Minor for so long, dude. It's the same thing. And he was going, dude, he was playing like an hour and a half. It's like, fuck.
That's a lot. that's extreme.
Yeah, but it's cool. Like, and then they got to a point where like, okay, let's go. Like, we get it.
Yeah, then, you got your fill.
Yeah, it's like kind of what it is with some, you know, metal records where it's like, okay, like we do something different now.
Yeah, and not for like novelty's sake either. Mm-hmm. But you know, I do think that there is a type of listener, maybe they're not musicians, maybe that's part of it. So I feel like a big part of at least our end of the metal world is bands that are, well, I mean, the bands are musicians, but their audience is primarily made up of musicians. Mm-hmm. And so there's the threshold for boredom is lower, but I wonder if the non-musician audience want the same amount of variety. I get the feeling they don't.
Yes, yeah, that's like something I try to think of too, because I feel like most people who listen to like extreme music or like I guess tech death, are nerds. Like we're all fucking nerds, right? Mm-hmm. And like everyone wants to hear like how crazy you can be and this and that, and like what are you doing different? And a lot of the time it can become a pissing match, unfortunately. But I feel like to the layman, it's like it's just so out there that maybe they can't even take it in. And then it's like, how do they know like what's good from not good just because of, you know, it's like
this. They just know if they like it.
Yeah, exactly. Like it makes them feel angry, or it, you know, it gives them some emotion, and then that's all they need.
That's cool. If you look at two of the most successful extreme bands of all time, Slayer and Cannibal Corpse.
Yeah.
They're both awesome in their own way. Both of them, though, even though they evolved their sound over the span of long ass careers, they have a very consistent type of sound. Like neither one of them has ventured too far off the path that their own path. Like they're not on anybody else's path. Like this is a musical path that they created and it works. And even though there's new influences, every Slayer record you hear something gets added. And the same with Cannibal Corpse. Every record, something is added. So like these are not bands that just write the same record over and over and over. There's evolution, but they keep it within the scope of exactly what that thing is that they do. And I mean, people love them, and I know that their audience is way more than just musicians. And yeah. I think about that a lot.
Yeah, Cannibal Corpse is like an anomaly, I feel like, in the death metal spectrum, because they started off, you know, like as like, you know, like very raw. I mean, they're still raw, but they start off with this like very specific sound, and it's like so much more refined now, and in like a totally different light. And obviously, like they're like the biggest death metal band ever. But like, I feel like there's something changed when Evisceration Plague came out, and they had like that slow kind of mid, like slow tempo kind of banger, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like everything kind of changed for them after that. Like
that
between
Kill and has some riffs on it.
Yeah. And like the production too, like it's way like, it's like so chunky and pissed, you know, like, and obviously that probably has to do a lot with, you know, like the time and technology. for their record sounding, you know, getting progressively more sick. But yeah, like, but like, that's to say, you know, like what people are, have come to expect as a listener from them, but it's like, you're saying like this, they stay within their bounds. While also
they stay in their lane.
Yeah.
I mean, they've definitely evolved, but they're not, you're not getting surprises, I guess. Like you're getting, it's like, I mean this in like the best possible way, 'cause I love them. It's like, even you, like, it's a very, very consistent output. Consistent as in lots of records, like very consistently, and they all sound like Cannibal Corpse, and like they're not taking crazy left turns that you would have with like a prog band.
No. And that's like, I think that's what people like. They like, you know, the comfort in knowing that like they can throw on any Cannibal record and it's going to make them happy.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe that's the difference between a musician and like a listener, like a death metal fan. But I mean, I'm a musician and you're a musician and we both love Cannibal Corpse, like every record, you know? So I don't know. They've kind of figured it out.
You know, for they have. But then there are a lot of commercial bands that I just don't get into. I'm not going to name them, but that I just am not into. Not because they're commercial bands, but because it's like so not adventurous at all. But they're so big that it makes me realize that, you know, and I don't think anybody, I'm not judging anybody's tastes. I'm more just reflecting on the things I think are important. Like, I'm very aware of the fact that they're not always in line with what other people find important about music.
Yeah. I know what you're saying. It's like, you know, I don't know if it's like in the songwriting process meant to appeal to a certain audience because it sells, or it's just like that digestible to where anyone can throw it on and listen through the song. But yeah, bands like that, I can't even get through a song. I'm like, man, I'm so bored. Like, this is so boring. Like, do something.
And people love it. Yeah. So the average listener does think they're doing something. So what am I missing?
I think we'd, I don't know, maybe like those kind of people aren't as experienced in listening to music. Who knows? Like maybe
or making it.
Yeah. Or making it, like, obviously, like, I feel like the more extreme you get on the metal spectrum, the more nerdy you get as well. And the more like, I feel like the more extreme, the more likely that people who enjoy that are musicians, you know? Like Alan Holdsworth, like I don't really know any people who listen to him who aren't a musician. And he's like so extreme on that spectrum of, you know, virtuosity. Whereas like Eddie Van Halen, it's like a good mix between both because the songs are written in a way to where everyone can enjoy them. Not to say that Alan's don't. I love every single like Holdsworth record, but he's like so far out there, you know, that I think it takes a while for people to accept that the guy's like kind of changing music.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to like understand. I think you just have to have almost like an insider understanding of music.
Yeah. And I feel like that's cool too, because there's like gateway bands in the metal world that are appealing to the masses and also introducing them to like what the underground is. And it helps everyone. There's some bands that I don't really think are that sick, but I see what they're doing and how hard they're working and what they're bringing to the entire spectrum. And it's a win-win for everybody.
I think sometimes like, well, even if I don't think it's that sick, how does a 13-year-old feel about it? Because that's what's important, really, when you're talking about a gateway band. Like, how are they appealing to 13-year-olds who are then gonna like go in that direction basically forever?
Exactly. And then like they like a kid grows up like being exposed to that band, and then I feel like that is for them a gateway into something much deeper, because of like, you know, how accessible that one band was. So, and obviously they grow with that band too, and they become like a lifelong fan. And like, that's kind of the goal, I feel like, for some bands, is to appeal to a younger audience, because like, I don't know, they grow with you and they're going to be, yeah, they're going to be there with you.
How old were you when you got into metal?
Fuck. I don't know, man. Like, I grew up in a metal household. It's like my uncle, my late uncle Mike, he was a guitar player, and he's like a big reason why I play guitar. And he was like listening to Maiden, and you know, like he introduced me to Maiden at a very young age, and Priest. And my first concert was technically when I was in the womb at a Eddie Van Halen concert, I guess, technically.
So it was baked in.
Yeah, it's kind of like it was just, you know, there. It wasn't, I think the thing that I discovered was death metal and extreme metal. I'm like, whoa, like this is like crazy. Like it's fast, like, and you can sound like that. And I think like Headbanger's Ball had a lot to do with like me delving further into the underground, like as a young teenager.
So young teenager when you like found your end of it, I guess.
Yeah, like, you know, obviously the classics of Metallica and Slayer, and then like Maiden and Priest, and then you get a little more interesting, like you find Children of Bodom, and then Children of Bodom like can lead you to like, I don't know, like Winter Sun or something, and then like you're like in this whole like crazy path, and you're like, okay, like I understand melody and fast music, like what about like dissonance and like heaviness, and then you find like Meshuggah, and then Meshuggah takes you down this path, and you're listening to Cannibal Corpse, and you're like, well, okay, this is insane. Like the amount of bands out there is insane.
Yeah, it's really, really a crazy genre. I don't know anyone who comes in at Cannibal Corpse, or who comes in at like Arcspire, or comes in at Emperor or whatever.
Yeah.
Like I personally have never met anyone who comes in there. So people shitting on gateway bands really should shut up.
Yeah. I mean, they're the ones like fueling this. I feel like a lot of it is fueling like the next generation of fans, you know, yeah, like
absolutely
introducing them to like what more there is, because they're taking influence from all the underground.
Yeah, totally. You know, I was never a big Cradle of Filth fan. I think that they got big too late for me to care. But a lot of people hated on them, and I just remember thinking, well, you can hate on them, but I guarantee you that there's a generation of kids who are then into Emperor because they started with Cradle.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not the biggest Cradle fan, but I think that new Cradle record is fucking really sick.
It's their best one.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah.
And I think like same thing with Dimmu Borgir, like they, you know, they started off in the same era as like, you know, well, a little bit after, you know, like Burzum and Mayhem and, you know, all that true Norwegian stuff, but they were hated on because of how popular they were. And they're like a gateway black metal band. Like they got me into black metal, like listening to Stormblast, like that like changed everything for me. And like, I know they got shit on all the time because they were playing like the Norwegian like Academy Awards or some shit. And like the whole community hated them because of it. Like it's pretty crazy.
I never understood it. In their case, I never understood it because they're legitimately great. And not like their music was definitely not watered down at all. It's still pretty amazing to me that they got as big as they got, but I think a lot of people were very offended that they became everybody's band, I guess, and not just like this well-kept secret.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like maybe, I don't know, I'm just speculating, but like the fact that passionate, you know, little corner of the world that is like what they kind of made. And then now the whole world is kind of taking part in it. Like maybe that like pissed them off or something. I don't know. But yeah, like Dimmu introduced me to Emperor, and then like, I'm like, fuck dude, like bands like this exist. And then like, you know, from Emperor, you like, you go and find like, you delve deeper into that, that rabbit hole. And then you find like, you know, Dark Funeral and Dark Throne, and then
Watain.
Yeah. Watain. And then like, the bands that come from that, like Crack Angren or something, or Flesh God, or Septic Flesh. Like, it's like cool to like experience all that just because you found one band that introduced you to that world.
Yeah. You really can go down a basically infinite rabbit hole. It's funny, man. I remember when I was leaving Berkeley, like, and my cohort of I guess friends and classmates were not, some of them liked metal, but they weren't like, they were afraid of going in that direction. I was like very much like into going in that direction, but they were, a lot of them were very negative about it. Even if they listened to it, they were just afraid because like not commercial enough. Like, how are you going to make this work? And so I remember when I left Berkeley, I went to Atlanta to start the studio and actually to start Doth. And most of them went to LA, to do nothing at the end of the day. And I remember them tough love me or like intervene with my like really bad decision. And I remember thinking even back then, like, I think you're not paying attention to how big the genre is. What you're comparing individual bands to like one really successful radio band. And if that's how you're comparing it, then okay, but the genre itself is huge, and it stood the test of time too. So like maybe the earning potential isn't as high as if you win the lottery and you know, band goes platinum. You know, that seems way more unrealistic, by the way. But if you're able to get a foothold in metal, you can pretty much keep it forever.
Yeah. Plus, like, you're doing something that you give a shit about, and you're not like selling your soul to make a buck, you know? Like,
I don't think, for instance, that like Chad Kroeger and Nickelback sold their souls. Like, I think they're doing what they want to do. And that's why I thought that those metalheads who try to do that are so wrong. Like, they're making such a huge mistake usually because they're not actually into that kind of stuff. And so they're going to go up against people like Chad Kroeger who like are that kind of stuff. And, you know, you're going to go up against bands who really legitimately are writing that radio stuff because that's what they're into. Like they feel it. I feel like it's really tough to compete against artists that give a shit about the thing that they're doing when you're just doing it for, I guess a predicted paycheck.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, like, I feel like most fans of music can kind of hear that, like whether they know it or not. Like, I feel like the average listener can maybe understand, like maybe they don't know how to like put it into words or understand why they don't like something. But I feel like you can feel when someone cares about the music they write. Like it's like put together in a way that conveys like a good emotion, you know, like you can engage with that song because like the writer like gave a shit.
Yeah, totally. And also though, you know, maybe it's not written for me and you.
Yeah.
There's that too.
I don't know, dude. I went back and listened to Creed, dude, man. That
when recently,
and that shit's good, dude. Like people talk shit, but dude, those songs are well written, man.
I haven't heard them in a long time, but I mean, they have to be well written, to have gotten that successful.
Because at work, like I work at this art studio, and as a joke. We put on Creed, and then like I noticed,
oh, this is pretty good,
dude. Like, don't turn that off. Like that record. What is that record? Not Clayman. That's In Flames. Anyway, that one Creed record is like, damn, this record's sick. Like, it's just, it hits like a vibe, you know.
I'll check it out. I never even listened to them back in the day. Like, I never even gave them a chance. I mean, I've heard the hits for sure, but the thing too is with hits like that that become that huge, I think people tend to forget that it's like a song that someone wrote. I mean, there was a time period where it didn't exist. Then someone got inspired and worked on it, and people made it just like any other song. And because it became super successful, that doesn't change the fact that it is somebody's art. It's interesting to think of songs that way, because once you've heard them in the public sphere, like long enough, they almost are, it's like beyond a song. It's hard to explain. It's like a cultural thing.
Yeah. And I think that like the contrarian like gives them ammo. Like if something becomes too popular, oh, well, I just don't like it, you know, like because of how popular it is or something.
It's a weird reason not to like something.
Yeah, but I feel like,
well, I've been there.
A lot of people, I mean, yeah, I've been there too. Like I've hated on stuff just because of, you know, like I was like, you know, fuck everything. Like that's not the underground. So yeah, I get it, but I don't know. It's good. Like if it makes you feel something, it's gotta be good.
Yeah, I agree. So I want to switch gears and talk about guitar, because there's some things that, I'm just curious about. Like we've talked about it when planning your riff hard stuff, but I want to hear more about it. And I know that listeners are going to want to hear more about it, but the way that you dial your tone and the way that you get that super percussive attack, can we talk about the gain setting, like how you set your gain, but also how you approach the picking, like how you approach the muting, like just the approach, because it's so clean. But I've heard you do it, and I've heard you do it like over a Zoom call with like the same microphone we were talking through. So I've heard it like in the most not ideal setting, and it sounded identical to the record. So like, I know it's real. So I want to know more.
I don't know. I just, yeah, like, I think it has a lot to do with the way that you hold the pick. And then like, I've obviously, that's probably number one, is just the way you hold the pick at a slant and an angle on the string. And then obviously the gain, like the less gain you have, the more exposed your playing is. So I feel like because I've come from that, you know, for the last 10 years of playing with low gain and just becoming accustomed to that, it's like made me not be able to hide behind gain and like own up to my shit. So
keep you honest.
Yeah, like I have to like sound good, or else like you're going to hear that I'm not sounding like I'm not hitting those notes correctly. So I think like maybe people don't like that gain is not that much in the stuff that I do, and that's cool, but it's made me a better player because of it. And that's like the reason why, is because you don't have a choice. Like if you want to sound like solid, you have to practice and you have to like, you know, make sure you sound that way. And the percussiveness is, I think from the pick obviously is like the way you hold the pick, and the way that you're able to move your right hand to where you don't burn out, to where everything sounds fluid. And that, and in order to do that, that could come from, you know, micro movements in your playing. Like I do micro movements in my thumb and my index finger. And then I have my wrist, you know, there, collabing with those two guys, when it's needed to like, kind of get like more attack, because you can only hit so hard by doing this, right?
Yeah.
But you also sustain a lot more energy by doing this. So like when I really want to dig into a part, like I have my wrist now to do that, and my wrist and my forearms not getting burnt out because I was doing this crazy picking the whole time. So like I've managed to find a way where I can do like almost like a circle pick thing, which is kind of like, you know, doing this kind of motion, creating like a convex with your thumb. And then I've been able to figure out like, you know, same thing with like a scoop thing with the concave of my thumb, like, and using my index to kind of help this happen. It's kind of allowed me to use less energy when I need to play things that are really fast. So I have more energy to play with my wrist and like become more percussive. Like when I'm like just doing, you know, quarter notes at, you know, 240 and it's like really heavy, chunky parts. Like now I have all that energy and I can just downpick everything and lay into it. But then when I switch gears to go like in, you know, 8th through 16th or 8 triplet, like I have the other guy that kind of smooths through all that. And, you know, maybe dynamics aren't really relevant so much in that part because it's moving so fast. But yeah, like I guess it's kind of feather dusting what I'm doing too when I'm playing at those speeds. Like I'm barely like touching the string, you know, like I'm just barely gliding across it. And it has a lot to do with like how pointy the pick is.
How pointy is it?
I mean, it's just that Jazz 3, like I know like players hate this pick in our tech world. Like a lot of people talk shit on them.
They do?
Yeah. And I think it's because of, they do so scratchy. I love them. I think they're great. They have a nasty scratch to them. I get it. And like, yeah, they're sick. Mm. That's the nylon Jester, right?
Yeah, it's a different material, but still small and pointy.
Yeah. Like these are the, I forgot what material this was. I think it's nylon too.
Well, this is whatever the Tortec, I think whatever the Tortex material is, but no, it's not. I don't know.
Yeah. But like a lot of people I've come across like just don't like these just because of how they sound. Like they sound scratchy and they sound they don't have the bevel. Like I use these two, like these prime tones, the sculpted Plectra Dunlops, and these are all beveled on the sides. Like they're the same shape as the Jazz 3. It's Jazz 3, but it's like more beveled on the side, so you can kind of glide a little easier. So I use that in like a lead application, but for like riffing, I kind of use the scratchiness and like it has like just more attack, I feel like. And it, because of that, it can sound more percussive. Like it might not sound good, like to an extent, like when you break it down and play it like slow, like it might sound like kind of scratchy because it's like, there's like a lot of resistance on the pick. Mm-hmm. But I think I kind of use that to my advantage because of that, and I'm moving so fast, it sounds like it comes off more percussive. And I haven't really been able to like do that so much with these kind of picks playing rhythm because they're beveled on the side. But I mean, I can still get the same effect. It's just like, I can't really get down to like the tip here, like the Goldilocks zone right there, you know, like the tippy tip tip. And that's like, and it allows me to like kind of glide in between the string at like a really fast speed and not like have any resistance in my playing because I'm doing micro movements and I'm not really using much dynamic. I'm like not really putting much effort into how hard I'm hitting the string because I'm saving that for when it really counts, you know, like on big chunky moments.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm curious about is, so on those super fast moments, are you engaging your wrist or like just engaging it less? Or are there moments where there's like zero wrist and it's all just micro movements?
I think it's like, it just depends on the context of the riff that, you know, like that calls for that. But a lot of the time, yeah, I'm picking and then like there's a part where it requires the wrist to happen. So it's like these kind of work in unison, and I use my wrist when I need to like really make a big adjustment. So it's kind of like it goes hand in hand. And there are applications where I'm just completely doing this. And I think that's a lot of to do with just like my string skipping approach, which is doing the scoop thing. Scoopy guy. And that allows me to like maintain like speed without like tripping over myself. Like, and then I'll use my wrist to adjust that for like the next application.
Just for anyone who wants to know more about the scoop technique, Justin covered it in his Riff Hard lessons that are either coming up or already out, depending on when you listen, when you listen or watch this. But the precision, the development of the precision is really impressive. And did you have to like do any mental relaxation work to be able to get to the point where you can play that lightly, but with that much precision? And it's like, that's hard for people to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's where you just, you know, you gotta like love to practice. Like a lot of the time, like, I mean, you gotta like really get off on just sitting in front of a fucking metronome and just shedding, because that's something that I've come to like really enjoy, you know, like when I'm working on a really tough part or something, or just trying to work out a technique, like it's comforting for me to like just really spend the whole day working on something. And like at the end of the day, like, I mean, I think that's what it is. Like you gotta practice it and be willing to maybe accept that you sound like not the way you want to sound. And because of that, you can adjust your technique. And that's like a thing that I took advantage of as a younger player, is like, I would just, you know, kind of fumble my way through something and then like be okay with it. I mean, like, oh, it's just like how it sounds. But now like, I'm like, I can't sound like that. Like I got to make sure every single note is, you know, audible.
That thing you just said, just saying, oh, that's just how it sounds. I think it's important to really fight that. It's almost a default for a human to go the other way when like, you know, there's certain things that in order to fix them, like it's going to take a long time, and you don't know how long, but you know it's going to take a long time and a lot of work, and you're going to have to really, really just face it. And I think that the natural tendency for a lot of people is when they start to get that feeling, just go the other way and just accept, just kind of like tell themselves that it's just the way it is and it's fine.
Yeah. And
you gotta,
I think,
fight that.
Yeah. You got to fight that. And you have to be willing to accept that you gotta first identify there's a problem and like the way that passage sounds, or like the way that you transition from one riff to the next. Like you got to first acknowledge that it's happening. And then from there you can like really start to like put time into like fixing that. Or I don't know, maybe some people just don't care, or they don't want to take the time to like get to that point. But I mean, you gotta analyze what your body's doing, and you gotta analyze like what approach to take to make sure that you're making your instrument sound the way that your mind is intending. And that requires you to like analyze like everything that you're doing. And maybe some people just don't like to do that. Maybe they're lazy, or like they just don't really care, or they just don't really know. And they're like, why can I not sound like that? Also, because you got to identify like what's going on.
So I've noticed all the above, because, you know, paid attention to people I've recorded, pay a lot of attention to Riff Hard students, people that have been in my bands, not Raphael and not Emil, but like other people who, not anybody from any of the lineups that anybody knows. All those musicians are great. But like, you know, from a long time ago, I remember a lot of musicians just not caring enough. Like I feel like a lot of people say they care. Like they say they care, and they kind of care, like they feel insecure about the result, but they don't care so much that they're going to sacrifice for it that much. Like, they're not going to not do certain things that are comfortable or fun in order to spend time doing that. Like, and I feel like actually caring involves doing things like taking action on it and deciding on priorities and like maybe not doing things that are fun. Like, I mean, I think it's fun to practice this stuff, but not, it's like, where's your hierarchy? Like, I know when I was younger, sacrificing social settings to work on music was just something I did all the time.
Yeah. I still do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was actually thinking about how maybe it wasn't a sacrifice.
It was a benefit, dude.
Yeah. But for real, like, and a lot of these people I'm talking about will tell you when you get into it, like, because sometimes they do think they care. So they do think they're getting distraught about it. So talk to them about it and come to realize that, yeah, they kind of care, kind of, that it's not where they want it to be, but they don't care enough to like not play the video game, to like tell like their significant other that, okay, maybe we're not going to hang out 7 nights this week. Maybe we'll hang out 4 nights, and 3 of those nights I'm just going to practice late. Like, they don't care enough to like make those moves that you kind of got to make.
Yeah. Like, it's elective suffering, you know, like you have to do that. Like, you have to suffer to get results sometimes. It sucks, but it's kind of truth.
Even if you love it, like, I think even if you love it, in order to get the results, you are going to have to put it ahead of other things.
Yeah.
Yeah. The question is how much.
Yeah. Like, I've done that a lot for this record, and it's cost me a lot in my life. You know, I did it.
I feel like athletes probably have the same thing where it's like, if you're a professional athlete, there is no choice in the matter in how much you have to put into being good at the thing that you do. Like, it is what it is. And I think that maybe the people who, don't care that much, but still manage to end up in bands. Maybe they're the ones who've got it figured out.
I know, right? Like, they've managed to balance the happiness and suffering. I don't know.
Will it drive you crazy though, not to fix that stuff?
To fix what, my plane?
Yeah, like if you identify a problem in a passage in a song, like. What would be the result if you just didn't fix it?
I'd get anxiety. Like, I have like this thing. I'm a problem solver. Like, I can't not fix something, and I can't not give up. I can't give up. It's just something I can't really justify doing, like, with anything in life. Like, that's probably why like the tracking process on this record has taken, you know, a lot out of me. And it's because of like, okay, well, I don't like the way that sounds, and I'm going to like figure it out until I get it to the way it sounds that I need it to sound. And like my playing too, it's like, I have to like revisit riffs a lot, because like when I'm playing live, I'm like, dude, I'm just fumbling through that part. And I'm like not happy right now. Like, I feel embarrassed. Like, I just fumbled through this part, and like, I'm embarrassing myself every night, and like, no one knows but me. Like,
so you're embarrassing yourself to yourself.
Yeah. It's like, I'm creating the scenario, but cause it's like, you're in ears. You can hear, dude, you can hear like, you can hear what your pick had for lunch. You know, it's like, it's like crazy. Like, the amount of detail you can hear in your ears. And like, you hear that when you're playing live, and you're like, dude, what am I fucking doing right now? Like, am I really out here playing this in front of these people? Like, I need to just take a step back and go practice. So like, that happens to me a lot. In between like shows, like in the van, all I need to practice, or like when I'm before I'm about to embark on another tour, like I need to like, okay, like you remember this part, like you sucked at, and like you cannot continue to do that and embarrass yourself every night. So like I would like, okay, like I'm gonna fix this. Like, this is my goal to fix this. And I don't care like what the cost, like I got to fix this issue. And that, like, because in doing that now you have to like rethink your entire picking process because of it. And you're like, fuck dude, like this is like just opened up this can of worms now. And like, maybe people don't want to do that. Maybe they're just okay with like fumbling through that 2 second part, you know?
So there's this thing I see in the Riff Hard group every so often where someone will post videos of themselves playing and you can see the tension. Like you can, they're having problems. Like they'll hit this threshold where they just can't go past a certain speed, or like they're fast, but it's all over the place. Or it's just like, there's problems. That's why they're posting. And, but you can just see that like the pick angle is not conducive to playing well. The way they're holding the guitar, the way that's all wrong. And lots of times it, you know, people will jump in and be like, hey, should probably get down to the mechanics of the whole thing. Like you can watch, we've got this video where like, you know, Wes will show you how to do it, or Dan Sugarman will show you how to fix that thing. Like these are some of the best players in the world. Like, or listen to the podcast and you'll hear that Misha, for instance, completely changed the way he picked. Like he picked one way, then took several months to learn how to pick from scratch because he was encountering those types of issues. But so you have these examples of people that are awesome who had to like reset the way that they do, the way that they play in order to overcome issues. And then the response, not always, but sometimes will just be that like, it's going to take too long. They've been playing this way for too long.
Yeah.
So they don't want to just like throw that all away. It's like, well, you're not throwing that all away. You're fixing it.
Yeah. You're electively suffering to have the advantage of not embarrassing yourself.
Yeah. I feel like if they post a video, it means they want to get better. So, yeah. or maybe it means they just want validation and to be told that that it's fine.
Yeah. I think it's just like, how much time are you willing to put into an issue, you know? And like, you were saying earlier, like there's a lot going on as an adult, you know, like video games, you know, relationship or work, or maybe you just want to write and you don't even fucking care about how you sound. You just want to get the song out. And I think that works too. And that's good. But I don't know. There's like times where for me, at least, like I need to like take a couple weeks to like really focus on my technique and why did this happen? Like, why did I sound like that? So I need to understand why and then adjust. And that like requires sacrifice and time too, you know? And like, maybe people just don't have the time or the energy to dedicate that to that. And then they might wonder why, or might be upset why they're not getting the results that they want. And that's honestly, yeah, it's just about the time you put into like your playing.
It sounds to me too, though, like you're saying that it's selective suffering, but based on what you said, that it'll cause you anxiety if you don't do it, like, sounds like that path is also
suffering.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to suffer, you may as well get something out of it.
Exactly. So it's like, what is the lesser of the evils? You know, like going up on stage and fumbling through a part and like being aware of it every night, even though like probably no one knows that you're doing that, but you do. And like being upset because of it? Or would you rather just suffer and figure out why you were doing that? That way you get on stage, you feel more confident. And there's more conviction in your playing.
Like you actually own the part.
Yeah. Like you figured out the reason why you were fumbling to begin with, because you put the time into suffering to figure that out. And now you get on stage, you play more confidently. You don't even think about the part anymore because it sounds good. And because of that, I think your performance comes off better because you're, you know, confident and you have conviction in your playing and you're having like a better time.
You can be present.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think it's worth it to do that. The thing that I find that the players that I like am inspired by all have in common is that if they don't do it, they like, that's just not an option. They don't do it, they're going to get depressed, or they're going to get anxious, or like they're going to become monsters to the people around them. Like, it's just bad. Like, they have to. It's this obsession that is, it's almost like a necessary thing, like breathing air or something.
Yeah, it's like some OCD thing, you know? It's like some players just have that drive to fix what they don't like about their playing, and then that might require them to completely redo everything they know. Like you said about Misha, because Misha, he uses two fingers, right? That was his thing.
I think so, yeah.
He's now adjusted to, you know, a different approach to picking, and that probably is frustrating to deal with. Like, if I had to completely change my picking that I've done like my whole like life of playing an instrument, like that would be like, that would just be,
it would
like
suck,
and it would, yeah, be very discouraging to want to play, you know. But some people have the drive to fix something they want to, you know, fix in their playing. It's like an athlete, like you're saying, like they want to get to that next level of, you know, that athletic, you know, achievement, and that requires them to analyze what's going on and how to adjust and train to be like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's a good place to leave this, man. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come on, and pleasure as always. And I really, really hope that this record crushes and just continues to spread the way I've been seeing it spread, because it really is great shit. And in my opinion, worth whatever suffering you put yourself through.
Oh yeah. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Anytime.